About you guys, everyone. This is Professor Amon-Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach, former city councilman for the city of Compton, former Compton College Board of Trustees, and former Compton Unified School District Board of Trustees. We want to welcome you to the Conscious Corner and hope that you enjoy this program that we have for you today. A part of our panel is Ernest McBride, archivist for the McBride, for Ernest McBride Senior Legacy, along with Brother Ihe out of Detroit, longtime activist in the Detroit area, and in all over, really. He's a traveling man. We call him the traveling man. And then we got Sister Linda out of Florida, who a longtime activist. Her and her brother, Reginald Muhammad, had one of the first culture of Black bookstores in Long Beach for years ago, and then she also worked with Ken Rubicam on Long Beach Black Press, as well as she is a founder and operator of her own, what she called museum.
Black Inventors Museum, absolutely.
Black Inventors Museum. That's a really an excellent collection of the contribution of Black people to health and to various other scientific innovation things. So we want to get started. This program is designed to create deep thinking and courageous questions among our guests. And now our guest is one of my favorite guests. He's my son, Amon-Ra, Amon Mandela Ra, who operates his own tech company. But before that, he was one of the premier educators in LA Unified, matriculating through the Los Angeles School District school system, become a principal, and had one of the most successful schools in the Unified School District, which he can share with you. But right now, he's over this tech company called Knowledge, I believe that's it, and that they are around the country trying to come up with various ways of incentives for young people to want to go to school and earn credits toward their college or vocational opportunity when they finish. They started a debit card for students where people can load up money for them, and he can tell you all about that. But I'll let him give you his recipe, his resume, and all the things that he's doing. But one thing I'm proud of, he's a family man. My granddaughter, Journey, is one of the most decorated school students, getting awards left and right. And he has little Amon Prince Ra, who's, I don't even know what to say about him. He's so far ahead of the game, you know, but he's a outstanding young man. And I'm just one, and his wife, Danielle. But above all, he takes care of his pops. You know, he keeps me smiling every now and then, and with a little tribute, you know, a little contribution every now and then. I appreciate it. So, my son, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, give me a brief history, and then talk about your company, and let's take some questions. No, you got to get on a plane to New York. You just got back from New York.
Yeah.
They have contracts with various schools all over the country. And so he'll tell you all about that. Go ahead, Amon.
Yep, no. For first and foremost, just thanks again for allowing me to be in community, because this is, I mean, everybody can be everywhere, anywhere else in the world, and we're here with my father, and it means a lot to me to be in community with y'all. So I'm his youngest, you know, Amon-Ra, youngest of six. I go by Principal Ra. I'm best known as being one of the youngest founding principals in LAUSD, founded a high school called University Pathways Public Service Academy, wrote a book on how we built that school up to be an amazing school. We graduated three consecutive years, 100% of the kids graduated. 90% of the students were accepted to four-year universities. And then I had this radical idea as a principal. I was like, man, what if students could get like their own college savings account, and then we can incentivize them with money as they go from kindergarten through 12th. And by the time they graduate, if we put in the stock market and different things like that, like a 529 plan, they could fund their future with a business or going to school. And I taught myself how to code, and I started to put together tools to make it work. And I quit my job and started to this business called Knowledge, where we help students and families be awarded with financial incentives such as stocks, Bitcoin, gift cards, money for attending school and learning new skills. And in the fall, we'll be releasing the first debit card with our company that will allow up to $4,800 of tuition rewards for up to 500. Glad to be here.
Well, tell me about the child care.
Yeah, so one of the projects that was really important to me as a high school principal was noticing that many of the students come into high school, and by the time they got to me, they were 13. The level was extremely low. And I started to do some research on it of like, what is going on here? And realized that it wasn't a first grade problem. It wasn't a second grade problem. It wasn't even a kindergarten problem. It was an early childhood problem, right? Like the kids that were starting in kinder were starting thousands of words or hundreds of words to thousands of words behind a student that was in a Head Start program, a student that was in a really comprehensive early childhood. So we started the Compton Legacy Early Childhood Center, located in Compton, to try some new strategies to accelerate the reading levels of students by the time they start kinder.
Yeah, but what about your books?
So wrote a book, a leader. My first book was a leadership book called Revolutionary School Culture. Became a best-selling book, and it was really awesome around helping principals and teachers revolutionize their classroom and school, which is good. And then have a kids book called Little City, Big Dreams. Really one of my favorite books because it's just an animated book. So that was really good. And then I think that's it, Pop.
Yeah. All right. Well, dealing with the education concept, how do you see education from the standpoint of extrapolating a sense of cultures at an early age of students wanting to go to school under this new administration? I mean, they're talking about getting rid of the Department of Education. We had one guest, Dr. Rosemary Allen. She says she's for them getting rid of it. I'm really not because, I want to get your insight.
You know, every time I get asked this question, I always say, you got to understand the rules of engagement and understand that the game has changed. And you need to understand the rules to the game so you can best be suited for the people you care about to win at the game. So, rather I'm for the department closing or against, the reality is that we still got to navigate it if it's there or not, right? Like it's been there the last, whatever, 80 years. We still had these results. You know what I mean? So we still have to look at what are we doing with our young people to accelerate the learning with or without it. Would it be harder? Absolutely, I believe. But we have to come together with solutions. That's the only way that we're going to resolve this problem is being able to get to a point to privately fund and organize and strategize around how we can best serve the young people in the system. You know what I mean? So that to me, the most important thing is how do you work within, but how do you also reinvest the resources that's needed to the kids in the communities that need the most. Because I can tell you, with artificial intelligence coming, it's a tsunami. There's a financial tsunami coming when it comes to automation, talent shortage, job market that we all got to be prepared for.
All right. What I wanted to ask you was, See, the Department of Education does not run the schools. They don't write curriculums. That's a local responsibility. That's why you have school boards. Parochial schools run themselves, private schools, but you got to have, all they do is make sure that the underrated, I'd see special needs students are being served, and that people are not violating the civil rights or the various student rights thing. They don't get into what's going on in the classroom and all that. That's a local thing, if I'm not mistaken.
So,
I
like, when
hold
you
on the
look at the
school board.
department, right? Like, when you look at the allocation of funds, they're the
Yeah,
guardrail.
they distribute funds.
They distribute funds. They guardrail. They distribute in regards of policy, legislation, and they do have guidance in regards of what are some things that are impacting the classroom, right? So, when you think about the that's a very important role. Now, things that will be restructured, right? What happened with guardrails, it's almost like a presence. You know that there's a presence of guardrails there, so you act accordingly. When there isn't no guardrails or there's uncertainty, that's where you could have a lot of I would say a lot of chaos because of the uncertainty, because of what happens if this happens. Like right now, protected, like Section 504 is a guardrail, right? That's what
What is
type.
Section 504?
So Section 504 is for those who are need adaptive needs, right? So let's say, for example, like our son, like my son has a phonological disorder with speech, right? But he doesn't have a learning disability, but he may need to have a few adaptive things for him in a classroom. He may have a health with asthma, and he needs to go to the nurse and get. So whoever the guardrails are putting 504 and some of the free appropriate education when it comes to Individual with Disabilities Education Act, those are all guardrails that was established by the Department of Education. You know what I'm saying? So will those things still be through a state level? Yeah. Could, but then now you got some different things. So it's gonna be unique. It's gonna be a exciting moment for sure in education.
Okay. What about your conference coming up?
Yeah, so as you can see, they got the book, Little City, Big Dreams, but the conference. We have a huge national conference happening in October in downtown LA, right near the crypto arena. For educators, investors, teachers, principals, district leaders to come and learn how we can combat chronic absenteeism and increase student attendance, re-engage teachers, restore schools, and reward students mainly. So it's gonna be at the JW Marriott in October, and we're gonna try to reshape education together.
Okay. Anybody have any questions right now, Brother McBride? You're on mute, Ernest.
Well, can I ask just one quick question?
Go
Because
ahead, Linda.
he covered a lot, but I wanted to ask, when you were talking about the colleges and debit card, so how do you have a proposal or how are you reaching different colleges?
Yeah, so our partners are focused on like the colleges that we have for the tuition rewards. Our role with our company is getting incentives, financial incentives, meaning like every parent that signs up for our debit card will be able to have an opportunity on our platform for their students to earn $10 or $5 or money to be used on that debit card to then be exchanged for. Once it's used, they get points for tuition to those 500 schools.
Well, I think it's an excellent idea, but don't you have to go through the administration first before you get to the parents?
When you say administration, you talking about like the school administration?
Yes, I'm talking about like the presidents or the administrators of the colleges. And the only reason I'm asking that because do you have a proposal or something that you're sending out to the administration of the colleges
Yeah, so like, yeah, go ahead.
to approve what you're doing?
Yeah, so all the 500 schools that are partner has already been approved with the partnerships that we have.
Okay, I should have known.
Yeah.
Now, you have any Florida colleges in there, like
We do.
FAMU?
We do. What I do, I'll send it. We don't have FAMU. We don't have
What?
FAMU.
Oh, you gotta have. I'm a rally. You have to. Yes.
Yeah. We don't have FAMU. So we would love to expand some of those universities, and we see it expanding. This is a pilot kind of that we're doing in the fall.
Okay.
But for those 500 schools have been committed because essentially they're offering a big portion of tuition rewards being used with this partnership.
Well, that's an excellent idea. I was just wondering.
Yep.
So can we go on your website or something to see all these different schools?
Yeah. So I also send it to my father to share with you guys, but I'll send a
Okay.
link so you can see all 500 of the schools that's going to be connected.
Okay, yeah, thank you. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Absolutely.
All right, Ernest, you have any
Yeah,
questions?
that's what along the lines I was thinking. And then, like he was saying about the kids, because, like, every time you pick up the paper and read it, the kids are not reading at their grade level. And you say that a lot of that stems from preschool, like being back before you even in a kindergarten, you should learn a lot of this in the home, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
I mean,
My father always
kind
said
of.
that the primary source of education is in the household.
Right, yeah. Because I noticed that, I thought about that because I used to coach for like 20 years. I coached a little youth track and field club. And then I noticed that the kids, you could, ask them vocabulary like questions or the meaning of things, and they'd have trouble with that. But the minute you come up with some kind of well, this was kind of before the rap, but like songs, boy, they could learn every word of every song on
Right.
the radio, and remember that. And then I wonder, well, why doesn't that transfer over? I know you got the brain mentality to learn and to remember all this stuff, so why don't you remember these other things? I guess the things we were trying to do was unimportant, but it seems like it was more important for them to learn that music and stuff than it was to learn what was in the school books,
Yeah,
That was.
it's complex for sure.
No, but that's why the incentives come in. We went to school, there were no incentives other than you get your butt whipped if you didn't go, or your parents would go to jail. What they're saying is, hey, look, times have changed. You got a different student, and not different from being a human, but different from their exposure. I mean, you got little kids that can operate a phone better than an adult. You got little kids that can work computers. You got little kids that are more exposed on television programs and things of this nature to sex, to drugs, to violence than ever before in history. And they come up with a different mentality. And so I tell them a little bit about restorative justice that you was one of the main pushes of Amen.
Yeah, so kind of what you described is like in the past it was like, yo, you getting the whoop, you getting your butt whooped if you're getting your A's, your B's, And now we're in a different world, We're in a different world where kids are exposed more. They don't care about a whooping no more. The kids now they say they stand on business. That's their thing, right? So now we look at, well, how can we get you this information? What will it take for you to get this information? Because we know if you can get this information, that's the gateway to a better life, right? It's education. That's the pathway to a better world. So if we can use financial incentives, rewards to do that, so be it. And that was the same thing of like restorative justice, right? Restorative justice is like, how do we restore something that was built? Like that's the principle, right? How can we make something right? So for me, my philosophy was, how can we restore like that genius back in our young people is by eliminating some of the barriers that exist around them. And one of the biggest barriers is like financial trauma, right? Like kids are looking at gangsters, rappers, the hood entrepreneur as the way out versus like education. So that's what we're restoring is the integrity of education through financial incentives.
You know, one of the challenges in education is that you have a generation that when we was coming up, most of our parents just send us to school. They weren't really involved in our homework. Because many of them didn't read and write, some of the elder ones. Some did, but many of them didn't. Now you have another generation where you have parents, some parents that do help their kids, but the technology and the scientific innovation make it complicated for any parent to help their kid with regards to the type of math that they're exposed to or the type of technology that they're exposed to. Tell them about AI and how that's going to happen.
Yeah, you know, I would say this for everybody on this call, if you got like kids or grandkids, mainly, you know, and that's younger people, they should be using artificial intelligence probably every day. Every day.
How so? Can you explain why? Why would they be using it every day?
I explain. So it's a few things. Right now, there's automation and artificial intelligence is reshaping the workforce, right? If you guys ever like go to like a grocery store and it's like, it's less human beings, you can do it yourself, right? Like they're starting to be where you go through a drive-thru, it's AI talking to you, right? Like there's millions of jobs that's being cut. Not even just the entry level, you have high level jobs like coders and software engineers who are now being replaced through automation and artificial intelligence. So the new skill that is going to be in high demand are those who know how to use the AI to work more efficiently, more effectively, and faster. Those and like, for example, for example, with Google, I don't know if you guys remember when you could search Google when it first came out. There's people today that still don't know how to use Google right. Right. And what I mean by that is, if you don't know how to use AI, 10 years from now, it is going to be difficult to thrive in that workforce. So what I mean by why I would get everybody using this tool is because it's going to be not only it's not right now, it's optional. 10 years, if you don't have, it's like not using a computer in today's world, right? Like not understanding AI is equivalent to somebody not having a cellular phone. In today's world, you don't have the tool to even be part of the world that is being built. So it is not, and I'm not here to be an advocate for it or to be against it, but as somebody who's in the tech industry, this is the reality of the world that's being built. And my daughter right now, she's 9 years old. She's been working with ChatGPT for the last 2.5 years.
ChatGPT
is an artificial intelligence. It's a large language model but it's pretty much one of the premier artificial intelligence prompt to text, prompt to image platforms out there. It's the leading AI platform, I would say at least. And my daughter, who's 9, is doing a presentation in her fourth grade classroom around how she uses GPT, chat, artificial intelligence, right now, right? Now, this is the real question.
Wow.
Some of you guys have nine-year-olds or no nine-year-olds who don't know what the heck AI is right now, right? Never been exposed to it. They're just on YouTube or playing games. By the time my daughter turns 18, her relationship with the technology is going to be so far advanced to the person who never was exposed to it or who was exposed to it when they were 14 years old, right? Meaning that if she wants to thrive or get employed from an employer, she will be able to perform at a higher level because she's had access longer to the information. Does that make sense? So the reason why I say there is a tsunami coming is the big companies are all looking at how can they make more money with less resources. So I will be more innovative to try to use artificial intelligence and cut it. So the tsunami right now is we need to start getting the skill sets that's needed for what's about to happen. If you ever see what a tsunami does, right? A tsunami happens, and if you don't put those, the tsunami pulls back. The water pulls back first, right? And it can shock you. You're like, oh, this is interesting, right? The water pulls back, and you're like, oh, this is an interesting beach here. And then little do you know is that water is pulling back, and it's gaining so much force. Now it's a wave coming back. And if you at that beach and you are there long enough and you can see the wave, it's probably too late, right? It's too late. That water is coming and it's coming fast. So what I'm saying is what's happening with technology and artificial intelligence is that it's pulling back. These big jobs, you start to see Apple and Microsoft cutting. They cutting these jobs. If they're cutting the jobs, what do you think happening to the little people? And now once if that wave come in, that wave is, oh man, I need to learn AI. If you said I need to learn AI in 2028, it's too late. Right? And that's what I'm saying. Like there's high school students who have never been exposed to artificial intelligence, and my daughter who's nine can outperform them right now. Right? That's scary. Because then what happens to a group of adults who don't have the skills for employers to want to employ? And that's what that's at least the work that we're doing. We're incentivizing kids to get those skills, not only so they can get money to thrive in the future, but they also have these skills and they're equipped with the skills to thrive in the future.
Are there positions for people to design AI programs?
Yeah.
In other words, like when computers came out, people learned how to fix them. People learned how to do this, do that. What about AI? Yep. What are some of the auxiliary employment?
Yeah. So that goes into what we call machine learning, right? Like you are developing machine learning, large language models to like learn and study a lot of data that's going in, right? So we got to be in that game. And let me explain why. In education, in K-12 education, we have something that's called like culturally relevant literature. Like if you see in my father's bookcase, he has like literature that is culturally connected to his value system, right? So teachers will try to create culturally relevant lessons, right? Now, because everything is technology, a lot of things are technology, we now need culturally relevant technology. Let me explain. So the technology that we use, Zoom, it's built off of a language. It's built off of what is called code, software code. Mm-hmm. But now, if I'm not culturally conscious as a person that's writing the code, especially with artificial intelligence, I can code my own bias into the technology. Mm-hmm. Right? So then now you will have what is called the coded bias, which is what we call digital racism, right? That happens and that manifests through this technology. So we have to be part of it to not only thrive in it, but to protect ourselves and our thought leaders and the sacredness of what we find value in. So it's an important idea, and I know it's hard for us to sit down and think about 30 years from now, when many of us are just trying to get through the now, right? But it's important for those two things to coexist. You have to have those who survive the now, but those who are the futurists to get prepared for that safe landing we need to have 10 years, 20 years from now, to give people that head start and that warning.
Okay. Brother Ahi, you there?
Yes, sir, Professor Ryan.
You have any questions or comments?
Well, Professor Ryan, as you told your son, the primary education of our children starts in the home. And your son having a success rate of about 90% graduation from the school that he started, either his children were in homes where our intelligentsia are heading the home, and education is important to them. Like you said, when we were growing up, a lot of our parents were blue collar. A few of them had college degrees. Most were high school degree, but they bought in. They bought in with the educational system. They bought in with the teachers, and many times have developed personal relationships with the teacher to make sure that their child tried to take advantage of the opportunity presented before them in the public school education. Today, unfortunately, a lot of our educators are looked as adversaries to the parents of some of these bad children. Well, I won't say bad children, but unruly. And the teacher is presented with a different set of problems. Because I don't think that all your children's parents were college degree, part of the intelligentsia here in the African diaspora. How did you get the parents to buy in? How did you educate the parents to participate in the education of the children? Did you educate them also? What was that process, if you had that type of process, or did you have all people who were disposed to higher education?
Yeah, great question. I wish it was like that, right? That all the parents was locked in and bought into like higher education. It definitely wasn't the case. Like my school is in Watts, right? It's in the heart of Watts. And it's in the heart of a lot of different dynamics. So what we did was we created what I call the intrinsic like motivation engine at our school, right? And we got kids to get bought in. Like I was a high school principal, so I still taught a class. I brought a lot of resources. I had partnerships with the LA Clippers, Planet Fitness. I built a music studio in my school. I had a full top of the line, state-of-the-art weight room in there. I had drones, headsets, gaming. Like I invested into creating the school that I wish I had, which I like to say it was like the YMCA for our young people. And it was an environment that I had I was lucky enough because I was the founding principal. I hired my teachers. So I hired culture-minded educators that was aligned with me, aligned with my vision. And as students came in, it was hard for them to fight against this place, this ecosystem we built, even though they may have a household that may have not promoted education as much as we would have liked them to. And because of this environment, it was just enough to get that student to want to finish, and just enough to say, you know what, I'm gonna apply for college, because one of our non-negotiables was 100% of our students had to apply, no matter if you went or not, right? So we had a school that my father said, he's like, sometimes at an early stage, you gotta love somebody more than they love themselves, right? And that was the philosophy I embedded not only in my staff, but in every stakeholder we had, is that because we knew some of the kids and the dynamics in which they came from, we had to love a lot of them more than they loved themselves at that time. And then what we found is over the course, if I had you from 9th, 10th, my cohort was 100%, because you got 3 years going into your senior year of this new unlearning you had to do with our ecosystem, if that makes sense. So that is what I said. It's not because we had 100% parent involvement. I wish we did, right? We were working on how we can increase that. But what we did do is we didn't take no for an answer. You know, that was our approach. That was our approach. And we benefited from that, and the kids benefited from it. I mean, we got to this day teachers that would come from, like, because my school was on a middle school campus. It was a high school shared with a middle school, and the middle school had their own principal. We had kids from that school that they was like, I can't believe you got them to graduate, right? Like, and that was, man, you know, an environment can do so much for somebody just by changing just one thing in the environment. Like right now with your house, if you just colored that, like that green wall, and you colored it, whatever your worst color is, if you painted that green wall that color, it's gonna change the way you sit, because you like, I can't stand the color of this dang wall, right? But if I go in and color something and it gives you a vibe, it changes the way you even walk. And that is what our school and our classrooms had for our babies, which changed the trajectory. And we'd like to believe we saved and transformed kids' lives for those 6 years.
Well, I went to his class, school. He created a culture, though. The kids came in and they
got in the house system.
It was already set. The tone was set. They had other kids. They had special, we used to call them homerooms, but he had, or the Obama, they were competing with each other for excellence and competition and incentives. So it was a culture that was set, like at Cal State Long Beach. When students came there, we had a Black culture already there. You understand? So when the students came there, you know, they were introduced to that consciousness. And many of the kids that came to that school, it wasn't chaotic. It wasn't gangs and tattoos and graffiti all over the place. And so they bought into that. You understand? As a matter of fact, the other students that were there set the example. They were like peers. You ever went to their assembly? It's a different assembly than you would go to at most schools. Their assemblies were upbeat. There was always entertainment. There was always participation by the students. You know, it was a deep thing to see, because you don't see that in high schools. You understand? They didn't have all the things that AI is being taught all over the predominantly white schools.
Professor,
all over. I mean, they're doing so much stuff, man, with their technology. And they was always ahead of us, you know, because our primary focus was discipline.
Professor Rob.
Yeah.
Let me say this. Now, what Principal Ra has done has been, it was an exceptional thing to happen. You would think that, especially the district that he was in, LA Unified, would find a way to partner with him to help these students be more successful. And I don't know, I haven't heard of anything like that happening, but he is a source that where something actually works. So if you have something that works, you tap into that and make sure you model it and copy it. So the majority of the kids in the district, you're talking about LA Unified School District, it would seem like there's a no-brainer. You have something that works, so use it. But that tells you what they really want, what the real agenda is. That tells you. So keep doing what you're doing, brother. It's exceptional.
That's not the right way.
Machinda, you have a question? You there, Machinda?
Yeah, good evening. No, just welcoming the brother back. You always good to see him, you know, uplifting. You know, it's a phenomenal story, you know, and I'm like Brother Rasaki. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I got disconnected. But anyway, you know, it should be modeled and could, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, I'm sure he's moving forward, you know, trying to continue to do what he do. But, you know, I was listening. I got in late because I've had to take care of some business and I just got on. So I don't know what was said earlier, but I caught on about the AI and that part, you know, and it's like, you know, I work in education, higher education, and I'm constantly reminding folks about that. I'm, you know, again, at where I'm at in my life, I'm paying attention to it. I'm near retirement at some point, you know, and been through the system. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I'm encouraging the very young people and folks that's going to be around for the next few decades, you know, working to remind them that we're going through a major shift. And it's amazing how probably 90 something percent of them are uninformed of what this conversation is about. And they've heard of, you know, they've heard of certain things. They've, you know, because I'll ask a question. Have you ever heard of artificial intelligence? Have you ever heard of AI? Oh, I heard AI. You know, they hear it because it's like a kind of a something they can remember. They hear AI. You see commercials. They hear different things. However, but, you know, I was listening to something the other day. They were talking about the banking industry, for an example. They say, you know, by 2030, I don't know, I think they said 2030, which is around the corner, that 30 to 50% of the banking jobs are going to disappear, you know, because the technology is there to replace. We have there's a call center in the local town near me, and the call center, they hire a lot of the people that live in the neighborhood, that lives, it's a poor area, pretty much. Most people are below the poverty line, the average citizen. There are people that are doing well, it's a mixture, but a lot of the citizens are working class and making a little above minimum wage and, you know, that kind of thing. So they opened up a call center. And so it gives them like, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe 500 people might work there. I'm not sure. I think it's about 500 people. And what they do is they answer the phones for various vendors, you know, for companies. They're contracted to take care of the business over the phone. And I was talking to, I use that as an example. I said that, you know, it's a great thing that they have this call center in the community because it's offering jobs. And the folks, they're making, you know, way more than minimum wage. I mean, they're not making grand theft money, but they have some peace of mind and a quality of life. It has been elevated. So it's a good thing. And so, but I was saying that I was using it as an example. I said, do you know that the technology's here to, you have 500 people simultaneously on the phones answering, reading a script. and answering questions and so forth. And so that's my explanation to them was, I say, look, do you know that all that's it's going to be replaced? But I said, it might not happen tomorrow or the next day. I said, but they could, I just give them an example. I said, here's a little box. And this little box is so powerful that it can simultaneously answer 500 calls. It can route 500 calls to it and intelligently answer all the questions better than the person that's on the phone, read the script better, and then give them the accurate information that they need and so forth. And I said, they can run that all night if they want to. And so I said that it's easy to replace people. And so I was just using it as an example that I hope it don't happen in the next whenever. But, you know, I said, hey, you guys got to wake up to what's happening. You know, you might not be for AI, or you might believe it's this or that. It's going down with or without you. And it's you know, how are you going to survive? You know, so where are you going to, you know? So anyway, I'm going to stop, you know, because I'm sure he explained all that probably the last 35 minutes or whatever, a lot of that. But I was just saying, man, you know, so I got a little couple of investments in AI, you know, as I'm making, I ain't making no grand theft money, but just kind of working the stock market a little bit and learning it and using, you know, NVIDIA as the stock that I'm using to try to learn what I'm doing. And I've been, probably last few years, I've been kind of paying attention. So, but it's a lot going on. It's a lot going on. So I appreciate Brother Principal Ra coming on and sounding the alarm, and keep up your good work, brother.
All right, Kumba, you up at Cherry Creek in Colorado, predominantly white schools. And are they functioning with AI?
Well, more important than that, they're all reading Amon's book and there's about five principals who's instituted his model within their schools. So, and one of the, when he came and spoke last year at the school, he also connected with one of our programs that just started, well, that's been in place, but the new cohort started this summer. So when we began to talk about AI technology, when we began to talk about artificial intelligence, when we began to talk about automation, Cherry Creek is probably one of the districts that's ahead, because we have a whole building dedicated to that type of instruction, a whole building, not just a class, but a whole building, and that building is expanding. So, and many of our kids, our Black kids, our diverse kids, they're all diving into the program, and you see a higher attendance there than in their regular classes, because this is something that's piquing their interest. Amon has had a tremendous impact in our district, but as well as the district is investing in that type of learning. Yes, sir.
All right. I used to teach, and they would talk about people going to space. You know, all they're going to space, they're building satellite. And you always tell the student, you're already in space. The Earth is in space. There's nothing up under the Earth. You're talking about, you know, all you're doing is expanding your experience in space. And that's the same thing with AI. AI is already here. I mean, you can call, you pay your credit card through AI. What's your last four numbers of your Social Security? What's your birth date? This is a tape recorder asking you that. You punch it in, they pull up your information. They tell you what to pay, when to pay. Ain't no human. You call the hospital. They got AI. Now what they're doing is expanding it to another level. I'm not, rescue me if I'm wrong, Amon. But Dr. Sharita's on, and she's into the health thing. And I don't know if she uses AI, if she.
But let me say
concerned about it. But let her respond. Dr. Sharita, are you there?
Yeah, quickly. I'm in the middle. I'm kind of like doing two things at one time. But yes, I do use AI because it's kind of not a way to get around it if you're going to be in business and be able to deal with these new markets, which is the younger generation or even the generation 40 that's thinking more about their health. They're all connected into the AI. So I use AI for certain things. Like, for example, we 50 years in business. We're looking for documents that we can't find from 1976, like some bylaws. We know there's a place we can find it, but there's so much stuff to look through. So it's like, okay, we need bylaws. So I put an information into the chat GPT. And then I think in 10 seconds, I had a whole bylaws written up. And I didn't have to change much. You see? So, yeah, I use it. Mm-hmm. I use it.
What do you think AI role will play in the future of health, Dr. Sherita? Let me tell you why. Let me preface it. I try to encourage all my children, and especially Amin-Ra, to make part of their curriculum about nutrition, about how to eat right. I mean, we used to go to the cafeteria. They had hot dogs, they had hamburgers. I mean, they everything we shouldn't have been eating. This new technology of teaching people to eat better, the importance of herbs and nutrition and vitamin D and vitamin A, B plus, and all of that. What role do you think AI could play in that? Dr. Sherita.
Body intelligence, connecting the two, just having it to where, for example, AI is just a fast way of getting things done, really. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to approve anything that's written before, you know what I'm saying, before you push it forward, you have to agree with it. It's just a fast way of using it, but I see it. If you, there was a tribe, I remember Dr. Layla Africa talked about a tribe in the Himalayan mountains where their education system included knowing about their bodies. And by the time you were age 30, you knew everything about your body, how to heal it, how what herbs to take, what foods to eat, how to treat your body, what's, you know, and you know where all your organs are and what they're supposed to do. And the only people who didn't know were people who just were having some kind of mental abnormality, you know. So when you know what your liver is supposed to do and your colon is supposed to do, you would treat it different, just like people treat their car. Mm-hmm. You know what the functions of, you know what I'm saying? So yeah, I can see it just teaching children the importance that a health is the most important, because if you don't have it, it don't matter about AI or anything else. But also, I do believe that we need to still install into our African curriculum. That's the reason why I came on, because of the title, is our spiritual connection, that our ancestral intelligence, that AI, our ancestral intelligence. And so we don't lose connection with what's reality and what's not. Because we're watching a lot of things as AI, artificial intelligence, and they're having different celebrities and just different people who are famous saying certain things, and they're not saying it. It's not them. You see? So we have to be able to still be able to tap into our intuitive, you know, connection, our ancestral, our universal connection. So that needs to be taught, however it is, what religion, whatever philosophy, but we need to make sure that our children are spiritually connected to the planet, to nature, to Earth. Mm-hmm. They need to still be able to connect to that, because if they don't, they're going to lose what's really artificial and what's real.
You'll start because you're going to go back to the value of human connection. You're going to see a world where artificial intelligence is going to be, our technology is going to be so mass produced. that people will spend a premium to just get involved with a human, right? What I mean by that is, you're going to want to get to a point where I get to a Dr. Sharita doctor that can give me that human interaction versus the layers of what AI will be proposing. And another part is, we still have to remember the sacred knowledge, going back to spirituality, but also of just like agriculture, because I do believe as a futurist, the great reset will happen, where the world gets so dependent on technology and then it gets stripped from you. Who has those skills of being able to rebuild? So it's
they even using AI for that in Africa. They're using AI for it's called agribusiness.
Yeah, but you lose so much of because then those who have that prior knowledge, who have kept it, they become so much of a value add, right? Because in education now, it's no longer just good enough to know the tool of AI. But what I tell teachers all the time is, don't grade the output, grade the input, right? Like Dr. Sharita, when you go and you prompted that ChatGPT, you had to critically think to prompt it right, to get
exactly
that right. Right? Yes. But if we just go and grade the result, we don't learn from the knowledge in which you gave the input from.
Right, exactly. It's just an instant learning. Yeah.
So we have to be able to then challenge our kids. Like when my daughter uses it, she's starting to catch like, oh, I'm not critically thinking about the prompt. I'm giving a basic prompt. Those who can creatively think and manipulate the technology will have the asset. But in order to do that at a high level, you have to have some level of creativity and prior knowledge to do it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but listen, what role is robots playing?
Yeah.
Robots, I mean, you got robots everywhere. And is that part of AI?
Yeah, for sure.
Because see, the challenge that many people are having is Dr. Sri was saying that, you know, the primary thing for all people, and I'm for AI being at the top of the list, but health got to come in, and by way of using AI, as she has already articulated, we can probably push the students to have more knowledge of their bodies, how they work. What, I mean, people say we got a liver, but don't nobody know what the liver do. People say they got a kidney, nobody know what the kidney do. But more emphasis, when we had health, all they talked about was venereal diseases and exercises, and eating three meals a day, drink milk, and walk, you know, water here. And that was the end of the class. But right now, there should be more of an emphasis, because people are dying from eating themselves to death, overeating, and things of this nature. And I was talking about how AI can help change that. You know, I wish I had the knowledge well, let me just say this. I hope in the future that we can get Dr. Sharita to come on by way of, she has a legacy. Her father was Dr. Paul Gauss. And Dr. Paul Gauss ran New Earth Health Store, one of the most popular and most, revered places that people go that wanted to prevent from getting sick, and they still exist. And we want to have her on to talk about her father, talk about his legacy, and talk about the legacy of nutrition and health. And by way, not getting away from the AI, but I really believe that AI, we as Black people should find how to use, we learn how the AI to help the white man world run. We need to learn how to use AI to get our mental, spiritual, and physical liberation. We're a new culture of eating, a new culture of understanding the world, instead of seeing it as Rashiki and he would say from a white perspective. Oh, you understand, right? Yeah, I appreciate you trying to get jobs and things, but it don't do no good if your life expectancy is short. But go ahead, Amen. If you have any
No,
other
no.
comments.
No, I mean it's I think that's they're interconnected, right? Like when you look at the when you look at like diabetes, when you look at some of the health concerns that still are heavily concentrated in low income, impoverished areas in our nation, right? So you have this interconnection of financial trauma along with all the other health risk that is correlated with that. So like they for me at least, they are interconnected when it comes to overcoming the financial trauma, allows some other doors to unlock. But I think AI, I think man, listen, I think we need Dr. Sharita, we need everyone to be fighting different battles, all coming together, looking at it, because they're all part of a system in which we have been trauma have got gathered trauma from. So that's what I'll land with.
Cool. You have any other comment?
No, just well, j just this. Thinking about everything that you've said, Pops, Amin and I are partnering with the Aurora NAACP to do a reading camp. And it's partly virtual and partly in person. And all the books are Black authors. And so they'll be introduced to some form of AI. The parent will be receiving training, and all the books are by Black authors. So when you talk about that input, it's also not just training the students, but also how are we training the parents? And so looking forward to this partnership. It's a pilot, and we actually have the orientation on Saturday. So I'm looking forward to knowledge coming in Amin's company to really putting those incentives around it, but also working through his company and working through his portal. There'll be some that those who haven't been introduced to AI will be introduced to AI. So it'll be a combination of factors. So looking forward to how that's going to turn out this summer for the virtual reading camp.
Yeah, and that sounds good. And we know it's going to be successful with both of y'all working it. But my point is that we have to learn how to use AI as a tool and a weapon for our progress as a people, not only in the United States, but what's going on in Sudan, what's going on in parts of Africa as far as health, technology. We got to learn how to use AI, not just for jobs in the future in major white companies and tech companies, and just to make it a living, but how it helps us culturally, mentally, and spiritually to be better people. And that's my point, that our whole needs are to struggle to be better people, and developing a different cultural apparatus that we practice is very key. So anyway, unless somebody have a burning question,
I
I
have
know you
one, like
got. Go ahead, go
I
ahead.
seen all this AI started back when I worked for the Navy on warships, basically what we worked on. So they was gearing all the AI toward making war, defeating the enemy. How can we beat, annihilate this other guy? And then, we started coming up with labor saving devices to replace people. Would you get one AI program, you probably could replace 500 people. Well, what are we? And my thought was always we replace and all these people with technology and machinery. Well, what's going to happen to these people? Now somebody should get an AI going, or what do we do with these displaced people? Are you gonna kill them off or what?
And listen,
somebody's got to be thinking about that.
That's the tsunami I'm talking about, right? Because because when you get the supply and demand, if it ain't enough jobs, right. And you still got all these people, what are they gonna do?
Yeah, because exactly. They gotta survive. Like Professor Rao was saying a couple of weeks ago, hey, your neighbors. Neighbor and you all friendly and everything now, but when things get tough, what happens, you know?
Yeah, you start seeing the purge, right? You start seeing different things. And we jokingly say that, but I'm serious, right? Like that is coming quicker than we can think about, right? It's happening in many ways right now, right? If you look at LA and some of our areas, you got our youth running into shops already purging. Right, like it's a movie. Yeah. Like here in LA, they purging stores and running and doing. So what happens now when it's at mass? They doing it in people's homes, right? Because if you look at the state of the economy, and I'm not trying to be a dooms person, but if you look at the state of the economy, you're looking at AI, you're looking at the loan debt crisis, you're looking at inflation there,
right?
That's all I'm gonna say.
Something to really think about. Yeah.
When we look at AI, we want to look at the bright side of it, but you know, with AI, like you said, a lot of our mid-level intelligentsia jobs, especially people with African diaspora, are gone.
Oh yeah,
they're gone, and the only jobs that the AI will not be coming after anytime soon are going to be the skilled trades. What are we going to do about those few jobs that are out there for the skilled trades because they can't do that type of work for? And how are we going to transition with this AI? Now, Jeffrey Hinton, who was one of the pioneers and the inventor of AI, said that he modeled AI after the human brain. He doesn't know exactly how AI works, just like we don't know how the human brain works. So if we don't know how this thing works, how do we protect ourselves from it when the inventor itself says that it very well could take over?
Yeah,
that's what Jabal was saying, you know, when he was on that. But
yeah.
We got to figure that out. Hey, brother, Roster T, you ready to talk about next week or tomorrow?
Yeah, we have Larisha Speaks on tomorrow. She's on the East Coast, and she's doing work with working with people and taking on the courts out there for Blacks in different challenges that they have out there that way. So she'll be on tomorrow speaking about her information. Mm-hmm. So that should be real good.
Yeah. Well, I'm probably going to lecture next Tuesday on a number of things. We got to just deal with what's going on in the political and the cultural dynamic of this new administration. Not new, but this administration sending people to prisons and things of this nature, and the probability of them also trickling all the way down to Black people as far as picking them up and sending them out. They're already doing that, revoking the Haitians' protective status and things of this nature. And these people have broken no laws. They were here legally, and they're just revoking their status. And that makes them illegal once they revoke it and paying them to leave the country. And we got to look at these things and try to deal with it next Tuesday, Arashiki. So I'll be the guest. Dr. Sherita Kumba, Ahi, Brother Ernest, and Rasha Keith, we want to thank y'all so much for this. And I mean, the reason I'm cutting it short to a certain degree is because I know you got to get on a plane in the morning.
Yep.
New York.
I appreciate
and
it, Pop.
Kuma, I know you got things to do so much in Denver that y'all are doing so progressively. You know, you every time I call you, you're going to a meeting and coming from a meeting. So it's it. So go ahead, Rasha Keith, close us on out.
All right. Well, each one teach one in Conscious Corner. Everybody continue to have a great day.
All right.
All right, you guys.